significance of what Obama renamed in 2015.
Well, renaming these, you know, we have been in this effort to rename our territories after what we call them as indigenous people. And this effort to try to erase indigenous people and erase our identities, that's what this is. It is manifest destiny in its modern form. It is colonial rule that is trying to control the narrative and is trying to erase indigenous people. And so we're going to continue to fight to hold on to our names. We're going to continue to fight to hold on to our identity. And we're going to use this energy that we have in Indian country right now, that we have gotten from this victory in fighting for Leonard Peltier, to protect our homelands and to protect the names and to make sure that they won't erase us. And you can guarantee the indigenous people that we're going to be on the front lines fighting this administration and making a way for our people and fighting for human rights everywhere.
Well, Nick, we want to thank you for being with us. Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of the NDN Collective. You can go to Democracy Now! To see all our coverage of Leonard Peltier, including interviews with him. Again, at the age of 80, Leonard Peltier is going home after almost half a century in prison. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, the Guster, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Turina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tim Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, down tempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland racial justice protesters win a settlement from the U.S. government for their treatment at the hands of federal officers in 2020. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield sues to block Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship, and Oregon's long legislative session begins. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. Some of the Portland protesters who were snatched off the street by federal officers in 2020 have won a settlement. Eight Portlanders joined a lawsuit alleging that federal officers used excessive force and illegally detained them during the racial justice protests in Portland in 2020. One had a hand broken by officers, another was allegedly pulled into an unmarked van while leaving a protest, and then detained overnight by federal officers with no charges filed. The protesters were represented by the ACLU of Oregon, and they settled for an undisclosed amount of money. The case had gone on for 4 years. One client, Mark Pettibone, said in a statement, quote, "This settlement gives local leaders the opportunity to lead by refusing to participate in violence against the people they represent and by rejecting the federal government's assault on our constitutional rights if federal law enforcement is deployed against us again," end quote. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield is challenging President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. He's among a growing list of attorneys general from around the U.S. doing so. The state's filing says the executive order clearly violates the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law and birthright citizenship. Children born in the United States are considered citizens, and they have been for centuries. The filing says Trump's order is illegal under the Constitution, the Immigration and Nationality Act, and two Supreme Court decisions. Oregon and other states are suing for immediate relief. They want a temporary restraining order to take effect while the court case plays out. Changing something like birthright citizenship would be a historic shift and an expensive one. Elizabeth Wydra is a law professor at UCLA. She said, quote, "An executive order that purports to change the meaning of the Constitution is obviously not constitutional. You need a constitutional amendment to do that," end quote. Rayfield's suit is joined by Washington and Arizona. Another coalition of 18 states is suing to block the order as well. The 2025 Oregon legislative session starts today, and the long session will put a lot on state lawmakers' plates. One of the key issues is transportation. A multi-billion dollar transportation package will be before lawmakers. They'll have to decide how to fund the Oregon Department of Transportation and which road projects to prioritize. Housing is a big priority for Governor Tina Kotek. She's called for more funds to build affordable housing and help people transition off the streets. Her proposed budget also sets aside more funds for K-12 education, about a 10% increase. The cost of living and the cost of fighting wildfires are also expected to be front and center issues this session. The last long session in 2023 was cut short by a walkout from Republican lawmakers. The Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, has announced it is joining with the AFL-CIO. The groups say with a combined 15 million members, they will seek to make it easier for all workers to unionize. Research shows public approval for labor unions is at a near record high. Isabel Charlet has more.
The Service Employees International Union is joining the AFL-CIO, a move that both groups say will make it easier for more workers to unionize. SEIU is the nation's largest union of healthcare workers, janitors, and security officers, among others. Combined with the AFL-CIO, a federation of over 60 national and international labor unions, the group now has 15 million members. Alan Dubinsky is with SEIU Local 49, representing Oregon and Southwest Washington. He says the two unions have a history of working together, and they share many of the same values.
We want to unite people across class lines, no matter where they live, no matter the color of their skin, who they love, so we can stand up to billionaire interests and corporate greed.
Research shows, although only 1 in 10 workers is currently part of a union, more than 60 million people say they would join a union if they could. In a statement, the AFL-CIO says they will fight for new rules to strengthen the rights of workers to organize and collectively bargain. Recent polls show unions have near record high favorability, with 67% of Americans approving of them. Last year had some major wins for labor, including the United Auto Workers, unions representing airline workers, and several Hollywood entertainment unions. Dubinsky says rights for workers can't be won alone.
As working people, we all want the same things. You know, we want jobs that are going to pay us enough to live. We want accessible, affordable, quality health care for ourselves, for our loved ones.
When workers organize, research shows wages increase and working conditions improve. In 2024, petitions to form or join a union more than doubled from the previous year. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
School is the place where most students get mental health supports. But Washington State is falling behind in providing these services, according to research from a mental health advocacy group. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
As young people struggle with mental health issues, schools often provide the best avenue for getting them help. However, Washington State has fallen behind in providing these services to students. Eric Bruns is a psychiatry professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He says school is the most common venue for young people to receive mental health supports. And so, from a public health standpoint, there's no better place to invest in resources.
That's because kids spend the majority of their non-sleeping hours that aren't at home in schools. And we have professionals there. We have adults who care about young people who can systematically or just informally observe when kids are struggling.
One concern is that mental health professionals are not spread evenly across Washington schools. A 2022 report from the mental health advocacy group Inseparable found the ratio of students to mental health professionals is high. For instance, only one psychologist for more than 1,400 students. Youth mental health experts say state lawmakers can help in this session by providing more resources. Anna Nepomuceno with NAMI Washington says legislators could also ensure Medicaid coverage of services in schools. She says students tell her mental health support at schools is a top priority.
There's a lot of students whose health insurance might not cover adequate mental health care, so they don't have access to it, or they're unable to find therapists, especially if you're on Medicaid. Sometimes the wait list to see a therapist is really long, especially when you're talking about youth mental health.
The superintendent of public instruction has proposed almost $6 million for grants to support school districts with the least access to behavioral health services. Nepomuceno adds school mental health resources were important in her life.
I went to a high school that was a bit more affluent. We had a school psychologist. We had a therapist. And I actually saw both of them. And I personally don't know if I'd be alive if I didn't have access to those services when I was young.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
President Trump made a pre-election promise to withdraw the United States from the World Health Organization, or WHO, which oversees a wide variety of global health issues. It appears he meant it. In one of many executive orders issued Monday after his inauguration, Trump announced the start of the process for terminating the United States' WHO membership. Trump repeatedly criticized the organization for being too slow to respond to the COVID pandemic and has accused it of being, quote, owned and controlled by China, end quote. As he signed multiple executive orders, Trump said, quote, world health ripped us off, end quote. Trump halted funding to the WHO during his first term and started the process of withdrawal. But when Biden took office, he reversed that immediately. The potential consequences for the WHO are pretty significant. They would lose their biggest donor, since the U.S. gave $1.2 billion to the organization during 2022 and 2023. That's hundreds of millions more dollars than Germany, the second-place donor. Experts also believe that the U.S. will face consequences for the decision. The WHO provides support to countries, particularly when they face a health emergency, and the U.S. would lose access to critical data on outbreaks, as well as its voice when health standards are set and disease responses are decided. Lawrence Gostin, director of the WHO's Center on Global Health Law, said, quote, this is a grave wound to American national interests and our national security. This will really leave our agencies like the CDC and NIH flying blind, end quote. Brett Schaefer, a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, said there are other ways the Trump administration can still be a leader in the global health arena even after leaving the WHO. Schaefer said, quote, there's hardly a lack of precedent for maybe addressing pandemic issues outside of the WHO. The WHO has in the past not been seen as either the most effective or the most responsive vehicle for addressing various international health concerns, end quote. It will take a year for Trump's withdrawal to become official. The U.S. actually set the time frame for any future withdrawal when it joined the WHO in 1948. On Monday, Donald Trump's second term as president began. Organizations prepare legal challenges to mass deportations and other Trump executive orders, and students study how best to bridge the political divide. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
Donald Trump is officially the 47th President of the United States. In his inaugural address, Trump outlined his plans promising a golden age for America and what he calls a revolution of common sense. Trump is issuing scores of executive orders, withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, pardoning 1,500 January 6th rioters, and freezing new regulations, among others. One declares a national emergency at the border ahead of expected mass deportations popular with his supporters. Immigration groups are preparing legal challenges. Barbara Lopez with Make the Road Connecticut says migrants contribute nearly $30 billion to Social Security and Medicare, and raids will separate families and remove longtime U.S. residents.
These threats are not only inhumane, but threaten to tear apart the fabric of our communities across the U.S. Immigrants are the backbone of our economy and vital to the strength and vibrancy of our nation.
Biden helped frame the new Gaza ceasefire, but Trump may impact its remaining phases. Sonia Meyerson Knox with the progressive group Jewish Voice for Peace calls him an active supporter of autocratic governments in the Middle East and the hard right in Israel.
Trump and Netanyahu are well committed to entrenching Israeli apartheid, expanding the dispossession of Palestinians from their homes, from their lands, reinforcing the military occupation.
A landmark California animal welfare law may clash with the new administration's farm policies. Proposition 12 sets minimum space requirements for breeding pigs, egg-laying hens, and veal calves. Some conservative lawmakers say it could drive pork production to China, but Allison Ludke with the Animal Legal Defense Fund says overturning it would create legal chaos.
It would have really damaging implications on states' rights, the regulation of animal products, pesticides, so forth. I think it could really cause chaos throughout the industry, both for producers and regulators.
Trump is also promising national unity at a time of deep division. Students at University of Pennsylvania's Political Empathy Lab crisscrossed that state discussing the 2024 campaign's issues and seeking ways to bridge the divide. Lab Director Leah Howard says the students emphasized using active listening.
Democratic listening is one of the most important and undervalued things happening right now because we're just so inundated by talk, expression. We don't get enough time to practice listening to another human being.
Though the post-election period has been calmer than the 2020 election, experts monitoring the process say there are no future guarantees. Maria Teresa Kumar with Voto Latino says candidates and voters have to understand and buy into the process to keep elections fair, free, and safe.
We have to remind the American public that regardless of who wins, the person that loses has to concede effectively.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at today's Portland City Council work session on Zenith Energy's push to expand its Portland terminal. At 6, stick around for Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 28 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and cold with a daytime high of 46. Today in history, in 1793, King Louis XVI of France is executed by guillotine after being found guilty of treason, kicking off the French Revolution. The quote of the day is from American Revolutionary War era writer Ethan Allen, who wrote, quote, "Princes may make laws and repeal them, but they can neither make nor destroy virtue. And how indeed should they be able to do what is impossible to the deity himself? Virtue being as immutable in its nature as the divine will, which is the ground of it." President Biden made a number of pardons on his last day in office, including for Indigenous activist Leonard Peltier. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. After nearly 50 years in federal prison, Leonard Peltier is free to go home. Outgoing President Joe Biden commuted the sentence of the Native American activist for his role in a 1975 shootout with FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation. SDPB's Lee Strivinger has more.
Peltier will serve the remainder of his sentence in home confinement. The pardon was seen as the last chance to free Peltier from prison, who is 80 and is in poor health.
It was the right thing to do, and it took way too long for a president to realize that.
That's Rapid City-based lawyer Bruce Ellison, who represented Peltier in the original case 50 years ago. Ellison, who was 25 at the time, says there was conflicting evidence against Peltier.
Clemency was at least an appropriate remedy.
The move drew applause from groups like Amnesty International and condemnation from Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota. Ed Woods is a retired FBI agent who runs the No Parole Peltier Association.
Whether he goes back to the reservation, he's in poor health. Jack and Ron are still dead, so Peltier has to live with the aging process just like the rest of us.
Gene Roach is a longtime Free Leonard Peltier activist who was there during the shootout in 1975. She was 14. The Minikoju Lakota says she's excited for Leonard to come home, but
our work is not done until all of our people are treated
with the basic human rights that we all deserve.
NDN Collective, an Indigenous rights organization, has purchased a home for Peltier on the Turtle Mountain Reservation, where he's enrolled. Biden's commutation takes effect on February 18th. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Navajo Nation hosted an inauguration watch party on Monday at the tribe's Washington, D.C. office. Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin had planned to attend Donald Trump's swearing-in ceremony in person outdoors, but was among the thousands of people who had to change plans after the event was moved inside due to cold weather. Temperatures were in the 20s Monday morning as Nigrin and others watched the event on TV. Nigrin says some things that resonated with him in President Trump's speech were economic development and public safety.
And some of the things in terms of public safety really resonated with me as far as how do we make our communities safer, how do we continue to make sure that us as Americans feel safe in the communities that we live in. So as president, and I think as a tribal nation, tribal leader, definitely trying to make sure that promises kept on Indian country because we all deserve it.
Nigrin says the Navajo Nation is putting together a list of priorities to work on with the Trump administration. As to Biden granting Leonard Peltier's freedom, Nigrin says he was glad it happened. He recently signed a letter of support for Peltier's release.
It's a Native elder that is up in age, and it'd be good for him to see his homelands again, to really enjoy where he comes from and what he's fought for when he was a young man as well, and for him to be back with the animals, the land, and the waters. What brought him joy and happiness to really see him enjoy that is going to be wonderful for not only Indian country, but for himself as well, too. So very, very proud and happy that President Biden took him up on that, because I know that that's something that was needed for a very, very long time.
Peltier himself often wondered if he'd see the world outside prison walls. In this 2000 interview I did with him while he was in Leavenworth, Kansas, Peltier shared this statement should he die before gaining freedom.
Being an Indian, I'm very proud of my people, especially those that have made good lives for themselves and made big advances just to help our people survive and thrive as a government. And if possible, I'll see him in the ceremonies.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull at the KLCC Studios in Eugene, Oregon.
Yesterday was Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and Dr. King condemned poverty disparities in his 1963 I Have a Dream speech. However, a new report from the Economic Policy Institute reveals that today, children of color around the nation still bear the weight of poverty. Crystal Blair has more in Missouri.
In his 1963 I Have a Dream speech, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. condemned the poverty that hindered Black Americans' rights. Yet a new report shows children of color still bear the weight of poverty. The analysis by the Economic Policy Institute shows that in 2023, Black, Hispanic, American Indian, and Alaska Native children were three times more likely than their white peers to live in poverty. In Missouri, there's a nearly 17% child poverty rate, just above the national average, revealing risks to children's overall well-being. Report co-author Ishmael Sid Martinez of the Economic Policy Institute says a major cause centers around employment disparities.
Black workers are more likely than their non-Hispanic white peers to be unemployed. And then when they do obtain some form of employment in the labor market, they're likely to earn less than their peers.
The report also reveals that Asian children are twice as likely as their white peers to live in poverty. Sid Martinez stresses that a key solution is implementing policies that ensure the social safety net effectively addresses the material needs of families. According to the report, the expanded child tax credit cut poverty for children of color by half from 2019 to 2021, lifting more than 700,000 Black and 1 million Hispanic children out of poverty. However, the gains largely vanished when lawmakers did not extend the tax credit. Sid Martinez emphasizes that stronger unions in the labor market would also help.
Unions help ensure that working parents have jobs where they have the necessary benefits and the flexibility of hours that they need to provide care for children.
Recent data shows Black Missourians face a 13.1% unemployment rate, nearly five times higher than white residents. Sid Martinez says that poverty reflects economic progress, highlighting that Dr. King's dream of economic equality remains unfulfilled. For the Missouri News Service, I'm Crystal Blair.
Last week on the Global Citizen Commentary, Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov looked at two categories of Donald Trump's nominees for positions in foreign affairs, the super rich and the loyalists. Today, he focuses on his extended family, people with a particular interest in the Middle East. Gertov argues, putting all three groups together, we have a kakistocracy, government by the incompetent. Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary on the issue. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Last week, I took a critical look at several people who have been nominated by Trump to serve in foreign policy-making positions. I looked at two groups, super-rich donors to Trump's campaign who have bought their way into an official position, and supreme loyalists whose chief qualification is subservience to Trump. Now let's look at a third category, what I call members of Trump's extended family. Trump will particularly rely on this group when it comes to formulating Middle East policy. Son-in-law Jared Kushner is once again knee-deep in corruption, this time being clever enough to stay out of an official position in the incoming administration. Writing in the online journal Popular Information, two authors traced Kushner's exploitation of his Saudi connections to make millions of dollars offering investment advice. Kushner's private equity firm, Alliance Partners, relies mainly on funds from Saudi Arabia's Public Investment Fund, which is subject to final decisions by the notorious Mohammed bin Salman, Kushner's buddy. Thus, while that fund hasn't earned a dime, Kushner draws huge sums in management fees from investors that now include Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. These investments total around $5 billion. The conflict of interest for Kushner, now that his father-in-law is about to return to the White House, is obvious. Kushner continues to advise Trump, maintains relations with Middle East dictators and with the Netanyahu administration in Israel, and is regularly on the phone with people in and out of government who want advice on Middle East policy. By law, Kushner should be a registered foreign agent of Saudi Arabia, but don't count on his doing anything of the sort. To the contrary, Kushner is likely to enjoy all the benefits of a policy insider without having to divulge anything about what he is advising. Jared's father, Charles, won't be involved in Middle East affairs, only French, now that he's been nominated to be ambassador to Paris. Charles Kushner is a convicted felon. He pled guilty in 2004 to 18 counts of tax evasion, witness tampering, and illegal campaign contributions. Trump pardoned him and tells a French newspaper that Charles is family. Steve Witkoff, slated to be Trump's Middle East envoy, is a real estate mogul with no diplomatic experience. Shortly before the election, Witkoff formed a crypto business that includes Trump as an investor. World Liberty Financial Incorporated has partnered with the Tron Network, a rival of Bitcoin and crypto transfers. The problem here? Tron is associated with groups designated as terror organizations by Israel, the United States, and other countries. One of them is Hamas, according to Reuters in a 2023 report. Kimberly Guilfoyle, the now ex-fiancée of Trump Jr., is slated to be ambassador to Greece. She has a well-documented history while at Fox News of harassment of an assistant, attempts to buy the assistant's silence, and inappropriate sexual behavior on the job. Sucking up to the rich and powerful was her game then and is now. Back in 2015, she called Greeks freeloaders, lazy and lacking ambition, for seeking outside help in Greece's debt crisis. But just recently, she reversed gear, gushing about her great love of Greece when talking with a Greek-American billionaire. I suspect Kimberly has been sent to Greece to get her out of the way of Junior's latest love pursuit. Then there's Masoud Boulos, father-in-law of Tiffany Trump, whom Trump has touted as a dealmaker and a, quote, highly respected leader in the business world with extensive experience on the international scene, unquote. In fact, Boulos is an executive with a trucking company in Nigeria that is barely profitable. Nor does Boulos own the company. It is owned by his father-in-law. All Boulos can claim by way of Middle East experience is that he helped Trump with Arab American voters. There is a word for the type of regime being installed under Trump: kakistocracy, government by the least competent. But these nominees are, with rare exception, not just distinctly unqualified, they are dangerous. In a political system based on merit, they would fail the Senate's confirmation tests. But even assuming the Senate does get to interrogate them, don't count on a vote to reject them. Watch as the supposed Republican doubters change their minds under Trump's pressure. After the Matt Gaetz disaster, Trump will probably prevail on enough Republican senators to get his people through. After all, who among them would dare to cross this president? If there is any consolation for this cacistocracy, it might be the chaos that is endemic to Trump's leadership style. Incompetence, or competence for that matter, will be balanced out by Trump's well-known inattention, egotism, and heavy reliance on Fox News. Before long, if his first term is any guide, these new nominees will be either ignored or replaced. So sit back and watch the show. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 21st, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Josh Salem, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Isabel Charlet, Brian Bull, Edwin J. Vieira, and Crystal Blair. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, wonderful folks just like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In December, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality fined Zenith Energy over $300,000 for illegally operating